now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit. Here's Nick Perez.
Yes, and how's it? And welcome to Life from the Pulpit, the cutting edge in biblical exposition. Coming to you on location in Merced, California, home of the Merced Church of Christ. This is the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, where I, your humble correspondent, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offer up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. Greetings and welcome to the program. So I want to continue this series, this study, concerning how we got the Bible. I taught this last year here in Merced. I've taught it elsewhere. It's always been received positively. I know it's something that a lot of people think about, and so I'm making it available to anyone who tunes into this podcast. You can learn how we got the Bible. So I left off yesterday. We talked about, in the previous episode, I should say, we talked about the various New Testament documents. Those works which comprise our 27 books of the New Testament. The question is, what happens to these documents after they've been written by Paul, by Luke, by John? Well, they are copied. Copies are made of the various epistles, the various gospels, the Revelation. Copies are made. I don't remember. It's been a while. I don't think I've talked about the scribal activities. If I have, bear with me. I just want to highlight. I believe I've touched on this in a previous episode. You can go back and listen to them. Alan R. Millard. He wrote a paper for the Biblical Archaeologist in 1982. And in that paper, he details the care ancient scribes used when copying and recopying sacred scripture. There are some out there, like Bart Ehrman. He's written a couple books about a bunch of, he talks about the errors, the mistakes that scribes made. They're only human, right? And as a result, there are, hundreds of thousands of textual variants. And while he's right that there are hundreds of thousands of textual variants, it's actually in the way those variants are counted that results in the high number, seemingly high number, of textual variants. Ehrman will point out that there are fewer words in the New Testament than there are textual variants. How can we know we've got God's Word? But the reality is, again, it comes down to how they count them. For example, by the way, a textual variant has virtually no impact upon the meaning of the text, and it absolutely has no bearing upon the gospel message. So I'll say that right here at the beginning. But I'll give you an example of what we're talking about here. A textual variant shows up in 1 John 1, verse 4. Did John write, "These things I write to make your joy complete," or "These things I write to make our joy complete," and include himself? It literally is the difference between one letter. So which is it? And how they'll count a textual variant. Suppose one manuscript has "our," okay? But 100 manuscripts read "your." Well, the textual variant gets counted as 100. There are 100 variant readings from that one verse. Perhaps, Mr. Ehrman, I'm being simplistic, but that's how I understand it. It's the way they get counted. That's how they get, and that's how Ehrman ends up with, you know, I don't know, several hundred thousand he has textual variants. And again, that's a small thing. Did John write your or our? That, and whichever one he wrote has absolutely no bearing upon the gospel message. So that's what we're talking about here with textual variants. By and large, they're not very significant. And textual critics can go back and they have reconstructed the original Greek text of the New Testament based on all the manuscripts that are available to us. Hundreds of thousands of Greek manuscripts available to us thanks to the work of scribes. Getting back to what I was originally talking about here, let me talk about some of the tools quickly of scribes. What did they use? They had the codex, the book that they were copying from. They would lay that across their lap as they were copying. They would have a pen, which was a reed. It would be sharpened. And a slit would be cut into it. It'd form a nub. The ink that the scribe would use was a carbon ink. It was black, typically, although some later manuscripts did have color. But it was made from soot mixed with water and gum. To erase, he had a sponge, which also cleaned his pen. The place where he copied this would be in a scriptorium, or a writing room. Those scribes who made multiple copies usually had their own scriptorium. Origen, who's one of the early Christian philosophers, had his own. And he had a team of copiers who would copy by dictation. That's another thing. Why are there some textual variants? Bart Ehrman will tell you it's because all these scribes were a bunch of dishonest schleps who were illiterate as well. Many of the textual variants that show up are based on the fact that words sound the same. Homonyms. We have them in English. They're there and there. Well, they had them in Greek too. And that's what happened with 1 John 1 verse 4, I'm persuaded. Words sound the same. Your and our, they sound the same in Greek. It just comes down to spelling. But let's talk about precision. Before he began, the scribe would smooth his paper with a piece of pumice. He'd then draw lines on a sheet to mark off the margins. These lines were colorless, and when it was all said and done, they were naked to the untrained eye, to the eye of the reader. He simply dragged a stylus over the parchment. That's how he did that. Writing commenced, and he would fill his columns with letters. Sometimes when a word would not fit in the column, he split the word, beginning it where he left off in the next line. Some scribes, they marked their breaks, but most did not. So that's a bit about scribes. Neil Lightfoot, in his book, How We Got the Bible, has a spectacular portion on the various scribal activities, a quote from the Talmud. Allow me to read what is written in the Talmud. Laws for scribes. A synagogue roll must be written on the skins of clean animals, prepared for the particular use of the synagogue by a Jew. These must be fastened together with strings taken from clean animals. Every skin must contain a certain number of columns, equal throughout the entire codex. The length of each column must not extend over less than 48 or more than 60 lines, and the breadth must consist of 30 letters. You see how precise they are? The number of letters per line must consist of 30 letters. And the number of lines per column ranges from 48 to 60. Very precise. The whole copy must first be lined, and if three words be written in it without a line, it is worthless. The ink should be black, neither red nor green, neither red, green, nor any other color, and be prepared according to a definite recipe. They had the very recipe of the ink down. An authentic copy must be the exemplar. from which the transcriber ought not to, in the least, to deviate. Listen, no word or letter, not even a yod, must be written from memory, the scribe not having looked at the codex before him. I mean, we're talking precision here. Bart Ehrman's going to tell you that these were a bunch of ignorant, illiterate, untrained, unskilled schleps who don't know the first thing about copying. Sorry, Bart, I beg to differ. Between every consonant, the space of a hair or thread must intervene. Between every word, the breadth of a narrow consonant. Between every new parasha or section, the breadth of 9 consonants. Between every book, 3 lines. The fifth book of Moses must terminate exactly with a line, but the rest need not do so. Besides this, the copyist must sit in full Jewish dress, wash his whole body, not begin to write the name of God with a pen newly dipped in ink, and should a king address him while writing that name, he must take no notice of him. God's name takes precedent over a king walking in and saying, "Hey, what's up?" You know, I wish more people had that kind of reverence for God and His name. And anyway, the rules in which these regulations are not observed are condemned to be burned in the ground, buried in the ground, or burned, or they are banished to the schools to be used as reading books. So you made a bad copy. It doesn't make the cut. It's not going to be read in synagogue, anything like that. So that's from the Talmud. That's the detail that these scribes, the detail to which they copied scripture. And so as a result of all the work that these scribes did, we have a myriad, a veritable swimming pool of manuscripts compared to the number of manuscripts that have survived from antiquity of other works, secular works, let's call them. Literally thousands of manuscripts exist today from antiquity. The form of writing, the style, the language could would change over the years in these manuscripts as the church looked to as the church sought to spread the word abroad to all nations, to all ethnic groups, just fulfilling the Great Commission that the Lord gave us. So when it comes to these earliest manuscripts, though, earliest Greek manuscripts, what were they like? Well, I'll tell you that in terms of the type of writing, they wrote in what were called uncials. Uncials are capital letters. So imagine, just for a modern illustration, let's say your scribe is writing on the keyboard. You're going to break off the cap lock. You're going to hit the cap lock key, break it off, because that's all they're going to type in. It's all caps. Got it? Caps lock is on. Of the 5,300 known Greek manuscripts we have, about 650 are written in only uncials. The development of lowercase, which are called minuscules, came along a little later after the first couple of centuries of into the modern era, into AD, as when minuscules came on the scene. The earliest manuscripts show that there were no spaces between words. Everything just sort of ran together. And I like to, when I present this to a live audience, I'll throw up on the screen a couple of columns of Romans in English, all caps, no spaces, and you can make out the words, and that's illustrative to show that in Greek, which was their language, they would have been able to read what was written. So it's essentially like typing with caps lock on and no space bar. All right, the vast majority of manuscripts that we do have are minuscules. They date from 9th century to 16th century. So lowercase came along later. So as far as that goes, so those are what the early manuscripts are like. And we have loads and loads of partials. But the rarity are partial New Testaments. At least partial as far as the 27 books are concerned. A lot of the manuscripts are complete for the purpose that they served. For example, you'll have manuscripts which are, they contain the four Gospels. It won't contain the whole New Testament, it'll just contain the four Gospels. And that was all they wanted, was the four Gospels in that one manuscript. It's complete for its purpose. Lots of people were gathering up Paul's epistles. And so you have manuscripts devoted exclusively to the Pauline corpus. It's complete for its purpose. So that's, you know, partial can be misleading in some cases. There are, of course, fully partial. I don't know what's the best way to say that, but there are some manuscripts which are truly partial. We don't have a full book of whatever. Some of the most famous are just portions of, like, James. There's one that has a brief section from James. It's just it's been, a lot of it's been lost over time. It's just an old manuscript. Some of the oldest stuff comes from John that we have. So that's, you know, there are some partials out there, but there are some complete codices, complete books, which contain a full New Testament. For example, I love talking about Codex Sinaiticus. Sinaiticus is truly a providential story. If this study is concerning the scope of God's providence in ensuring and maintaining His Word throughout human history, this is a fantastic illustration of God's providence in action. Sinaiticus, Codex Sinaiticus, was discovered by Constantin von Tischendorf at St. Catherine's Monastery at the foot of the traditional site of Mount Sinai. Baskets full of old manuscript leaves had been set aside at the monastery for the exclusive purpose of the monks keeping themselves warm in the winter. Yes, that's right. They were taking old manuscripts and burning them. Trying to keep warm. No telling how many manuscripts we lost until Tischendorf showed up. Tischendorf was a smart, smart guy. Lightfoot's got a section on his book all about him. Just brilliant, brilliant guy. Doing work that nobody else could do in his day. In his 20s. I mean, I'm 26. This guy was an expert. He was someone that when you couldn't figure it out, you called him in. Just phenomenal. Anyway, he shows up. He found only one manuscript on his first trip to St. Catherine's Monastery in 1845. But among the leaves that he found, leaves are just pages of a manuscript, there were 129 leaves of a codex containing both Old and New Testament. Now, he finds these 129 pages, but he's not allowed to take them with him. He can't leave the monastery with them. They're property of the monastery. They've got to stay there. But he was able to copy several pages. He copied from the Greek text of Isaiah, copied part of the book of Isaiah, and he returned to Germany, published what he had, and didn't tell anyone where he got it. He just published it, and everybody, you know, they wanted to know, where'd you get this, where'd you get this? He didn't tell anybody. It was his discovery, and he was going to make sure he did it right. So, a few years later, almost a decade, 1853, Tischendorf returns to St. Catherine's Monastery, looking for more manuscripts, but also looking for that one that got away, so to speak. And he was disappointed. He could not find the codex that he had to leave behind. He did find a piece of Genesis chapter 24. It was being used as a bookmark in a book, but that was about it. He finally decides, 6 years after that, 1859, I'm going to make one more trip. I'm going to go back one more time, and if I find it, I find it. If not, that's going to have to be it. And so he goes back and he spends some time going through the library there at St. Catherine's Monastery. Cannot find that manuscript at all. Just disappointed. Until a monk there at the monastery pulled him aside into his room, and in his little cubicle type room, on the top shelf in that room, he pulls down this volume that's wrapped in a red cloth. And Tischendorf, you know, he's sort of got this feeling in the pit of his stomach, like, no, I don't. He's just been disappointed so much, he didn't want to get his hopes up. He's like, I don't know, man. And sure enough, as that monk unwraps that red cloth, there it is, the codex. The codex that he had found all those years ago. And so, before, when he discovered it, he hadn't been able to cover his own emotions. They got out of him, and that's how they knew there at the monastery, hey, we've got something here. We better not let this guy have it. He's able to contain himself a little better. Hey, that's neat. You got a nice little codex there. And he's given permission to take it to his room, and he stays up all night copying as much as he can, all night. He evaluates that parts of the Old Testament are missing. The beginning chapters of Genesis, they've just, through the years, they've been lost. Some of the Psalms are missing. But he had a complete New Testament. He is given permission, after some finagling, to talk the monks into letting him go to Cairo with that codex. They didn't want to let him go, but they finally let him go. And Tischendorf, with two assistants, copied and checked, line by line, letter by letter, 110,000 lines of Greek text. Man, you want to talk about going blind on paperwork. They copied this whole... How long do you think it'd take to do that? A year, 2 years maybe? I mean, that's a lot of lines of Greek. These guys did it in 2 months. 2 months. And in the spring of 1862, Tischendorf had 300 reproductions of the codex made for the Tsar, Alexander II, and he presented those to Alexander. Since Tischendorf went and made that discovery, about a dozen leaves from the Old Testament have been discovered at St. Catherine's. That was after a fire in 1975. They were able to find several other leaves, but that discovery of Sinaiticus, it's now on display somewhere. And in fact, you can actually look this up. Go online, Google Codex Sinaiticus. Codex, C-O-D-E-X. Sinaiticus, S-I-N-A-I-T-I-C-U-S. Codex Sinaiticus. And you will find there's a website where they have put it all online. You can search this codex yourself. Very awesome. Marvelous thing that you can do with technology. So I've looked at it. It's pretty cool. Totally interactive. But I got to press on here. Next, another significant codex is Codex Vaticanus. It's been called the most important witness of the text of the New Testament. This is the library, which has been at the... that's been at the library of the Vatican since 1481. Been there for a long, long time. For many years, very few people were allowed to view it, let alone copy it. Just to get in and see it was a feat in and of itself. Tischendorf, though, was one of those individuals who applied to go in and see it, and he was eventually allowed, after his application, he was allowed to go in and see it in 1866. He's allowed to see it, and much to the chagrin of Vatican officials, he copied about 20 pages. Wasn't supposed to do that, but he did it anyway. He was allowed eventually to spend more time with it. And in 1867, he published the most perfect edition of the Codex up to that date. Codex Vaticanus is composed of 759 leaves, pages of the finest vellum. Each page is around 10 inches square. And just an interesting manuscript. Vaticanus, there at the Library of the Vatican. Got to press forward here. Alexandrinus. It's called Alexandrinus because it survived in Alexandria down in Africa for several centuries. It was eventually added to the Royal Library in 1627. Survived a fire in 1731. You want to talk about providential. Dr. Richard Bentley, in his nightgown and wig, rushes out of the Royal Library, clutching to his breast Codex Alexandrinus. This composes 773 pages, leaves, 630 of the Old Testament, 143 in the New Testament, leaves of vellum, very fine vellum. The New Testament has suffered some significant loss. Several pages are missing. It's interesting to note here, this contains portions, at least, of all the New Testament books, and it includes 1 Clement. But 1 Clement is actually included sort of as an appendix, which would indicate that down in Egypt, 1 Clement, for some time, was recognized as probably semi-canonical. I don't know if it was full-blown canonical, but semi-canonical is how it was viewed. By the way, of all the New Testament manuscripts we have, Alexandrinus, the only Greek manuscript to include 1 Clement. So before you can start getting uptight about, are we missing a book in the New Testament? Nope, no, we're not missing anything. Codex Bizet is the fourth one that I have on my list. A very early example of a bilingual manuscript. You have Greek in the left-hand column, Latin in the right-hand column. The Gospels appear in what's called their Western order, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's how we know them. This was one of the only manuscripts available for use when the King James Version guys were translating back in the early 1600s. But, another interesting note, because of additions and omissions, it wasn't consulted. Too many textual variants for the King James Version guys. Last one I have here, Codex Ephraim. This is what's called a palimpsest. That literally means scraped again. You know, writing materials were not always readily available like they are today. I can reach over here, grab a piece of paper and a pen if I wanted to. It hadn't always been that way. So parchments, if you needed another page, you would grab a piece of parchment that had already been written on, you just rub the text out, and a new text was written over the old. It's not like our ink today. You know, we think of paper and ink like we do today. Our ink today bites into the paper. Theirs didn't. It sat on top of the paper. That's why you could scrape again. You could have this palimpsest. Well, back in the 12th century, Ephraim, by the way, dates all the way back to 425. These are old, old manuscripts. 4th century for Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. Alexandrinus, 5th century. Ephraim's another 5th century manuscript. But in the 12th century, this guy Ephraim of Syria, he scraped again a Bible. This guy had the audacity to write over the biblical text to record 38 sermons. And he has the loche honor of having this manuscript named after him because of that. Not the only time that was done, by the way. For years, this was a locked box to textual scholars until Tischendorf, at the tender age of 25, I'm just a year older than he was when he did this. Tischendorf attempted to do what no scholar had done to that point. He attempted to reconstruct the Codex's text, and he did it. It took 3 laborious years, but in 1843, he published the New Testament and the Old Testament in 1845. Each letter had to be examined, and with very fine eyesight and perseverance, Tischendorf did what no other scholar up to that time had done. I'm out of time. Well, it just flies when you're talking about manuscripts. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. Always like to hear what you have to say. Do try to read your comments online. Also, like Life from the Pulpit on Facebook. You get all our updates when we go live with a new show. Also, you can follow me on Twitter, @nPulpit, the letter N, as in Nick Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T, @nPulpit on Twitter. Be sure to stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, www.lifefromthepulpit.wordpress.com. Also check out Merced Church of Christ website, mercedchurchofchrist.org. A lot of sermon audio there for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. And as always, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.